Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. You might have seen that I just released a new video over on YouTube about the queer secrets of the show Bewitched, and how this bizarre sitcom from the 1960s managed to be about homosexuality without ever saying so. For this week's episode of the Sewers of Paris, we're jumping into the archives for another conversation about witchcraft. It's my 2015 interview with a Minnesota entertainer named Joe, a sister of perpetual indulgence who was inspired by imaginary worlds and TV witches to conjure up magic wherever he went, whether it was on military bases or his ice cream truck. But first, a quick thanks to everyone who supports the Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and get some backer rewards. And a reminder that I've got a weekly newsletter for all the stuff I'm working on. You can sign up at mattbaum.com. Each week I give you a little sneak peek into upcoming projects, little bits of fun, weird cultural artifacts I've uncovered in various archives, and of course, links to cute animal videos. Also, check out my YouTube videos for deep dives into queer pop culture history. That's at youtube.com/mattbaum. The latest one is all about the queer secrets of the show Bewitched. And I hope you join me for one of our regular live streams. I hang out every Saturday on YouTube starting at 11 a.m. Pacific, and on Twitch at twitch.tv/mattbaum every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoon at 5 p.m. Pacific. Now, here's my 2015 interview with Joe. Welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm Matt Baum. I'm here with Joe. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for joining me.
So tell me about the entertainment that changed your life.
There's a man named Fred Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
He's a snappy dresser, sweaters.
Shoes, too. He sometimes changes
That's
shoes.
That's true, yeah. Shoes. Uh-huh. You know his mother made all of those sweaters?
No, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Really?
Like, I believe so. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
This is a picture of my mother. She knits the sweaters that I wear when we have our television visits. She makes sweaters for many different people. But that's one of the ways that she has of saying that she loves somebody. She uses needles and yarn and her own hands to knit the sweaters.
You know, my mother told me that I used to name all of my stuffed animals Fred. And she said, well, why is that? And she goes, Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. But there was just something magical about that. And then for, you know, a half hour, you'd learn a little something, and then you'd go to this other magical land. And
was it the make-believe, the imagination? Was that a big part of your life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. He encouraged it.
Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. a suburb of Minneapolis, yeah.
Describe for me what kind of neighborhood it was.
I lived on a cul-de-sac mm-hmm. Called Kirkwood Lane, and it was right next to a lake called Schmidt Lake, and it was a very, very tight, close neighborhood. As soon as the streetlights came on, we all had to go home, but there's night games is what we call them, or dusk games, really, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. Kick the can, snap the whip. All the neighborhood kids used to get together. It was a good little cul-de-sac.
That sounds so charming and small town.
Yeah, but I'm sure it happens in different forms all over.
And you mentioned that Land of Make-Believe was an important part of your childhood. Was that something like, did you do like a lot of pretend games and fantasy? Did you have like a rich fantasy life?
Yes. Part of Amy Bonison, who lived down the street, I have vivid, vivid memories of her and I and some other neighborhood kids doing puppet shows. And I remember getting a puppet theater once for Christmas and then opening up these boxes and literally crying. You know, sobbing. I was tiny. And my mother's like, you know, what's wrong? What's wrong? You know, don't you like what Santa brought you? And no, I was just so happy and mm-hmm. so excited for these puppets. So that really, I think, started getting me into theater and land make-believe. And then putting shows together, inviting the rest of the neighborhood kids. And, you know, I feel sorry for all of our parents because they had to sit through these amateur puppet shows, but it was full-on production in my mind, mm-hmm. you know.
Tell me about the shows that you put on.
Oh my gosh. I remember the City Mouse and the Country Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
That was a classic. Princess and the Pea, and I remember cutting out sheets of foam and painting them in detail and the backdrops and,
So you said that it got you more into performing and puppetry. Is that something that stayed with you through your childhood?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've always had a very, very... I've been attracted to puppets. I love the whole life that can be given to these inanimate objects, mm-hmm. you know. something charming about it and magical.
Did you have inspirations, like, aside from all the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood characters?
I mean, when it comes to television, I still do watch children's television because I love it. Like, Yo Gabba Gabba.
Yo Gabba Gabba!
What was the question again? Now I can't stop thinking about Yo Gabba Gabba.
That is a good problem to have.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have performers or shows that inspired you, or movies that inspired you as a performer?
Well, you know, Bewitched, actually. Mm-hmm. Bewitched. I loved Bewitched. Samantha. I love the name Samantha.
Mm-hmm.
I named my first puppy dog after Elizabeth Montgomery. What is one of the main elements in that show?
Witchcraft?
Well,
magic.
And magic, yes, magic. And so I thought that was quite spectacular. Just,
did you get into magic?
You know, there was a brief moment
mm-hmm.
I got into magic, but that quickly disappeared. Although I do have vivid memories. There used to be a magic shop in downtown Minneapolis called Eagle Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And you would walk in there and it reeked of smoke. Mm-hmm. And there was this old man that looked like a bulldog behind the counter. And he had this deep, deep, raspy voice and was smoking a cigarette. Thick framed glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And the walls were just packed with shit. I mean, every hardcore, like super professional magic props down to the amateur stuff, right? And of course, every time a kid walks in, he would waddle on down to the amateur section of the magic tricks. Oh, this is what I got now. This is what I got now. And my dad would buy me a magic trick here or there. But yeah, that magic never, the art of illusion, yeah, or David Copperfield, you know, that type of, never really struck a chord with me.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, I lived in Las Vegas for 11 and a half years, and one of my guilty pleasures, and still today, is bad magic, watching horrible bad magic. And there's more magicians per capita in Las Vegas than anywhere else in the world. So you can find really bad magic shows in Las Vegas.
There's also like people who, like, you clearly can see what they're doing with cards.
Oh, but part of that, you have to have good banter. You have to have good stage presence. You have to, you know, sell the trick or illusion, excuse me. When it's done poorly, it's brilliant. I love it.
Was your family supportive of you doing performance?
Absolutely. I did lots of local theater, obviously at school, and then at other theater companies and children's theater companies here in Minneapolis. When I said, oh, I want an agent, and they were totally supportive with me, and they never said no.
What was the line where you started going from, like, this is just something I do for fun, to this is something I do professionally?
It became an obsession. It became something I couldn't and cannot live without. Like, there would be no way I'd be able to work in an office or in a cubicle. I need to create on a daily basis, or I will die.
Mm-hmm.
Plain and simple. I will die if I do not create on a daily basis.
So what were you creating? That would have been like when you were a teenager or so?
Either if it's acting or performing, mm-hmm. or if it's puppetry. Now, I currently, since I live in Minneapolis now, I currently work as a floral designer, which I didn't know I could do, but apparently I can. It's creating, like I said. My brain goes to that spot. We have the Perpich Center for Arts and Education here in Minneapolis, which is kind of like the Fame High School. You have to audition to get in.
Mm-hmm.
During the morning, you have your academics, math, science, and then after lunch, you have your chosen art area. So dance, theater, literary, visual, so on and so forth. You have the audition to get to the school. This is high school. You even have dorms on campus for those who live outside of the city. Yeah, so that's where I graduated high school from. But once again, it was...
What was it like to go to a high school that was so focused on what you wanted to be doing?
Life-changing, honestly.
What was your concentration there?
Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Theater.
What shows were you in?
This is high school. Bertolt Brecht.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The Caucasian Chalk Circle.
What's going through your mind when you're up on stage, when you're performing?
I'm not thinking about my bills or my everyday life or the laundry or relationships, or it's there in the moment. And it's, once again, it's imagination. You definitely do escape. But while I'm there, the audience is also with you as well. Mm. They're not thinking about their bills or their laundry or their relationships, no matter how good or bad.
So what kind of roles were attractive to you in high school?
Comedy. Mm-hmm. Anything that had a lighthearted edge to it.
Like what kind of shows or what roles did you like?
Charlie's Aunt.
I'm not familiar with that.
Charlie's Aunt? Oh. Long story short, there's some lying that goes on, and to cover their lies, this fellow's best friend, he dresses up his best friend as his aunt. So it's, they're in drag. People fall in love and so on, and chaos ensues, and things get...
Mistaken identity.
Right, you got it. Exactly.
It's sort of bosom buddies, Weekend at Bernie's, importance of being earnest.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Alice in Wonderland, mm-hmm. My favorite book and story of all time. I played the Mad Hatter, and that was like... I knew it inside and out. I still know it inside and out.
What was it about that character that you liked?
Oh, not don't think Disney.
Sure. So there's the Edwin, right?
Yes.
The Disney one? Yeah.
Oh, and he's brilliant, yeah. Edwin.
No, you'll get crumbs in it.
Oh, this is the very best butter. What are you talking about?
Tea?
Tea? Oh, I never thought of tea, of course.
No.
Tea?
No, not tea.
Sugar?
Sugar, 2 spoons. Yes, 2 spoons, thank you, yes.
No. The book. You got to read the book first and mm-hmm. paint your own story to it. Because the Mad Hatter, to me, is actually quite sad and lonely. He gets in a fight with time. That's the reason why it's always tea time. There's always a tea party going on because his good friend, Time, and him got in an argument with the Queen. And he's devastated over it. So, and Time stopped the clocks. So he's stuck in this loop over and over and over again. Sure, he's spastic and he has his outbursts and stuff, but it's just a little sad. Mm. But funny at the same time.
Did you know, when you were in high school, did you know that you were gay?
Well, first of all, I prefer the word enchanted.
Oh, even better.
I'll tell you, I knew when I was a kid, you know, and I think all kids, you know, oh, you're going to get married and blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah. I said, no, this is before gay marriage was legal in the state of Minnesota. I remember seeing in my mind's eye, it never made sense for me. Before I knew I was queer, I never saw myself in a tuxedo next to a white dress. I didn't know why. Mm-hmm. I wasn't afraid of it. It just didn't make sense to me. And then, maybe about 13 or so, I was like, whoa. 13, 14, I'm like, wait a second. Then later, in my early 20s, then it made sense to me why that didn't correlate or I didn't relate to mm-hmm. as a kid.
Were you still living in Minneapolis then?
Yeah. Oh, are we going to do the coming out story part?
Yes, please.
This is fun. Okay, so... I'll tell you what, there's, you know, let me go back here because, you know, I said earlier that my parents have always been supportive, and they always have been supportive. There's one thing, and I'm not big on regret. There's one thing that I would have been different, but it's not. After I graduated from the Arts High School, I come from a successful family of doctors and lawyers and they own their own companies and hoo-ha, and then you have this beautiful sideshow that sits before you. So my father was very adamant. He's like, listen, Joey, you know, you're really good at what you do, because you need to have something to fall back on. You need something else. You can't just be in the arts, right? So he's like, what would you like to do? And I'm like, if anything, I would love to write commercials. I hate them, but I love witty, smart commercials. So I went to school for commercial design for one semester. That's one bit I wish I didn't do. Okay, but so we went to orientation to this design school, and we're on the way home, and we're talking about advertising and things like that. And he actually advertises in Lavender Magazine, which is the queer newspaper here in Minneapolis. So we started. Oh, I was like, well, Dad, do you advertise anywhere else besides the magazine, you know? So now we're talking about, you know, gay topics. And then he made some type of remark of, oh, well, you know, all lesbians hate men. And I'm like, really? I'm like, I don't think so. I said, you know, I have a lot of lesbian friends. And he goes, oh, yeah, is that so? I said, you know what, Dad? And it's just me and him. in the car, and I say, I know this because I'm gay. And there was a moment of silence. And then he turned to me and he said, Joey, I love you even if you had carrots growing out of your ears. I was like, that's adorable. And funny. And then we just continued on with conversation. And we got home. And I knew immediately that he'd go and tell my mother. But I had to... At that time, I worked at a theater, a playhouse, in their ticketing office. And I was like, all right, orientation was great. I'm going to go take a nap before I have to go to work. And then all of a sudden, I hear on the door, and my mother comes in, and she sits down on the edge of bed, and she rubs my back, and she goes, Joey, I just heard that you came out, that you're gay. And I said, yeah, yep, yeah, I am, Mom. I'm like, I want to get some sleep now. And she keeps rubbing my back. There's a moment of silence, and she goes, so what is it about guys? She goes, because I like a nice round ass on a guy. I'm like, well, Mom, that's one of the things, but we're going to talk about this later. And I was 18 years old. It was May 1st, and I was 18 years old.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I know, yeah.
Okay, well, it's great that... clearly, they didn't have difficulty processing this news.
I know. I think... I mean, I don't know. I'm not a parent, but I would think you would know if you have a queer kid.
Do you think, like, this was completely not a surprise for them at all?
I don't know. I mean, before that, they've caught guys sneaking out of... friends sneaking out of my room. But...
Okay.
Yeah, I mean... But I don't know. You know what? I never asked. Mm-hmm. I never asked them.
So they caught boys sneaking out of your room, and they're like, well, maybe he's just totally straight, and he likes to have boys in his room.
Let's find out. Let's call Mom right now.
Okay.
Yeah, let's see here. I think... Oh, I bet you they're up at the cabin. Hold on. Long distance, northern Minnesota, right here.
Okay.
Hello.
Hey, hi, Dad.
Hey, Joseph, how are you?
Oh, I'm above average.
You're about average. That's too bad.
No. I said above average.
Huh?
Oh, that's all right. Hey, listen, Dad.
What?
I have a question for you. Do you remember when I came out?
Yeah.
Did you know I was gay before I came out of the closet?
Well, we suspected. Why?
I'm just curious. What made you suspect?
I guess because you were more into the plays than playing ball, and you were into show tunes and, you know, the art and all that stuff.
All right. Cool, I was just curious. Alright, listen, I love you very much, and I'll give you a call a little later.
Why did you ask that question now?
Because I'm doing an interview.
Okay. Well, remember what I told you when you said that you were.
What was that? I love you too, Dad.
Love you too. See you this weekend. Bye.
Yeah.
Oh, you're so lucky.
Yeah, I am. I really am. I mean, I have friends. I know people. I'm sure you know people. Mm-hmm. We know people in our lives who have been absolutely disowned.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately disowned. And it's so incredibly sad. And it's not the person coming out fault. It's that their parent or their loved one saying, oh, I can't deal with this. Well, you got some shit you got to get over.
Mm. So you went to school for advertising for a semester.
Yeah, for a very long semester. And I knew, because we were in there, you know, I can draw. It's a cartoony drawing, mm-hmm. right? That's it. You know, draw a bowl of fruit. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, the rest of the kids in the class, they have that eye for shadow and blah, blah, blah. And, like, it's like a photographic representation of a bowl of fruit, you know. Mine looks like something out of Garfield.
Mm-hmm.
I was just like, you know what? This goes against every grain in my being. I can't. And we need to do something about this ASAP. So I had the option of either moving back home with the folks or going to Las Vegas. And I chose the latter.
What was in Las Vegas?
Have you been before?
Everything, I guess.
I knew that I could perform, and it would be warm.
Okay. That's true. Coming from Minnesota, that was probably a good thing.
Yeah.
So did you go, did you have like any job prospects, or did you just like pick up and go?
No, it was literally, I made a sign on some tag board that said Las Vegas or bust. Mm-hmm. This is no joke. Threw it to the back of the U-Haul and drove down to Las Vegas.
And just showed up.
And yeah, showed up, unpacked. I got my first gig with being there a week, within the first week of being there.
What was the show?
It was actually, I performed at the Venetian as a mime, Pagliacci.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in Pagliacci, or, like, wow, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Just some, like, kid, some 20-something kid.
Yeah, basically. And yeah.
How'd you get the job? Like, did you...
I mean, as soon as I got there, I started asking around, okay, cool, where do I find auditions, so on and so forth, and... The Venetian was hiring what they call Streetmosphere, or Atmosphere performers. They have a bunch of opera singers and clowns with the gondoliers and everything, right? So I remember going down and into a cold, empty room. There, oh God, who was it? Who did I audition for? Anyways, he's like, just show me what you got. I just improvised a bunch of stuff, and he's like, can you start tomorrow? And I said, see, I was a mime. I didn't say anything. Yes.
You got the job.
I got the job. Mm-hmm. You know,
did you enjoy it?
Oh, yeah. I did that for about 2 years, I think. Year and a half, 2 years. And then I would audition and do commercials and other gigs on the side. Mm-hmm. At night, there in the clubs and stuff, you know, they have performers, or at the conventions, you know, they hire either, you know, spokespeople or Atmosphere, clowns, and all that.
How'd you fit into the culture there? Did you just show up and like, I'm the new guy and make friends? Or like,
basically.
How'd you fit in?
I think pretty good. I did it for 11 and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it started with, you know, getting stuck in a box, and then the box opening, and then, you know, working your way up and start performing and actual shows, 2 shows a night, 8 shows a week.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to entertainment, of course, there's rejection. Everyone goes to auditions they don't get and stuff. But, you know, I always had steady performing work there.
What'd you do when you weren't performing?
I would be at home. Well, a lot of the time, especially when I got to the point that I started getting booked in actual shows, I worked 4 or 5 hours a night. That was it. So my days were... I had nothing to do. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do. Well, I would show. I would show puppets. And then costume pieces. I always made my own costume pieces. Then towards the last few years before I left Vegas, I was like, I gotta do something more now. And so I bought a truck and made it into an ice cream truck. And then I sold ice cream during the day for a few hours. People threw me stupid money. Now, this is a classy ice cream truck. Let me... say that. I mean, I had the paper hat, the bow tie. It was an experience.
Sure.
It wasn't anything like crusty.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
What made you do that? Buy an ice cream truck?
Well, it's magical. It's whimsical. It brings me back to my childhood on the cul-de-sac. You know, that was so exciting. Like, all of a sudden you heard the chimes in the far distance.
What song did you have in your truck?
Oh, I had music from... There was a fellow who did an entire CD of ice cream music.
What?
I know. We have to find this. But it's just a CD of all like really whimsical, magical, enchanting ice cream truck music.
Uh-huh.
And so it wasn't like any of the other guys either.
So you just have like all these different songs playing from the truck.
Mm-hmm.
How did people respond?
Oh, they loved it. Mm-hmm. They absolutely freaking loved it. And then I'd book that at special events, because mm-hmm. Vegas is full of special events. Do house parties, mm-hmm. and then sometimes at my days off, I'd take the truck to the local queer bar, park it outside,
So you just like hanging out outside the gay bar, handing out ice cream. Oh, yeah. That's amazing.
Not handing out. No, you got to pay for that, let me tell you. But yeah, it was fun. I'd go to like the big kids, is what I called it. So I'd do all the industrial parks where everyone's working, right? Mm-hmm. And it was a great excuse for all the adults to come out and take a break and
get some ice cream.
Get a Choco Taco.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was the queer scene like there?
The queer scene?
Yeah.
In Vegas?
Yeah, that you parked outside the queer bar.
Well, I mean, come on. A gay bar is a gay bar is a gay bar. You have your bars that are close to the strip. Mm-hmm. Which are going to be more clubby and discotheque and drag show. And then you have your local bars as well. So mm-hmm. The ones closer to the strip obviously are a little more touristy. The local one, they all have slot machines at the bar. Mm-hmm. It's like your phone, right? It drives me insane. You know, it's this glowing rectangle, this electric leash. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden, if it's going to start paying you out money, people go to the bar, they sit there, they have the cocktail, and they play the machine. And when I first got there, I'm like, why isn't anyone talking to other people? They're stuck with the freaking machine. This is locals, too.
Mm. That's funny, because I never see those machines getting used in gay bars in Seattle, where I live, or even Los Angeles, where I lived before that. You know, you'd see those machines in the bar, and it was very much like, who plays those?
Are they actually in the bar, or are they, like, on the wall next to the serving bar?
Well, I guess they're, like, on a counter, or, like, you know, they're off to the side. They're in the building.
Yeah, no, these are built in, like...
Like, inside, like you put your drink down. Right? Oh, my God. Yeah, so you just can't avoid them.
You can't avoid them. And then you get free booze, too, if you're gambling. So.
Okay, well, that's not bad. Yeah. So it sounds like that kind of gets in the way of culture sometimes.
Oh, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the major reason I moved from Las Vegas was to, after 11 and a half years, was to be close to the family, mm-hmm. to be an uncle, the lack of culture. Now, I hear that it's improving, but... Now, okay, excuse me. Let me take that back, because that's not necessarily fair to say. The lack of culture compared to other cities I've been fortunate to live in and experience, okay? Because, just for instance, here in Minneapolis, we have some type of festival or art gallery opening or a new play opening or a food festival every single freaking weekend, right? And they're not necessarily little things. I mean, they're big to-dos. And you have those in Vegas, but listen, it revolves around Las Vegas Boulevard, that entire strip there. And maybe just because I worked on that strip for 11 and a half years and my life revolved around it too as well, maybe I was just like, listen, I need a little bit more. It's stuck in a valley in the middle of the desert. Nothing is around for 100 miles in either direction. It's an island in the middle of the desert. And after a while, it eats at you.
Like it just gets kind of stuck in time because there's nothing changing?
No, God, no. Vegas changes on a daily basis. They blow something up, tear it down, build something new. It's just growing up, I think, in Minneapolis. And, to quote Dorothy, there's no place like home. By the way, Judy Garland is Minnesotan.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Frances Gunn.
Mm-hmm. Well done. So queer.
We have to know these things.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about some of the other shows that you were in, like after the Venetian one.
I performed at Planet Hollywood in a show called V, the Ultimate Variety Show.
Okay.
And it is, the ultimate variety show. So it's a little vaudevillian. And what it is, the entire show is act after act after act. So you have everything from Wally, a world-famous juggler, to your MC, who is Jeff Hobson at the time. I love you, Jeff. Who is a comedian, magician, drumming to a flea circus. And that's what... I did Professor McGreevy's Flea Circus. So it was a clown act. And I was actually the pre-show.
What was your pre-show?
Well, my clown character came out on stage and danced a little bit, and then pulled out a suitcase and opened it up, and inside the suitcase is a little merry-go-round and a trapeze and a cannon. Mm-hmm. And a diving board with a little pool, you know, and got an audience member from up out of the audience to help me with the fleas perform. And then everything goes awry, basically. Mm. Comedy, comedy, comedy. So it was a mixture of clowning and puppetry. Mm-hmm. Together.
Mm-hmm. What other kind of puppetry stuff did you do?
Oh, hey, well, we could take it back a step. So after I moved to Las Vegas, I was there for two years. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, you know what? Maybe I should go if I were to go back to school, to college for anything, it would be in the performing arts somehow. That's when I went to the London School of Puppetry. Mm-hmm. And I studied with them. And when I was there, I also was fortunate to study with the Jim Henson Company.
In London?
In London, in the UK.
What did you pick up from studying with Jim Henson Company?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it was invite only. We did a lot of camera work. That's the majority. That was the main focus was camera work. So all about eye focus, entering, exiting the frame, straight scan, reverse scan.
What is that?
Whoa. It depends on the monitor. Because when you puppeteer for television, mm-hmm. you need to see... It's different than performing live. If you puppeteer for television, the proscenium of your theater is your television screen. So you need to be aware of what your figure is doing on the screen, the audience, and everything. It's all about eye contact.
What kind of characters did you perform?
I'll tell you about the marionette.
Okay.
Which was called Biscuit, right? This is one of our... not finale. It was one of our tests, whatever. We had to build a marionette, perform a marionette in front of school children. So it was called The Biscuit, which, for those of you who are from England, is also a cookie, right? So I made this marionette and rigged magnets in his hand, and it was all about this little boy, this little character, seeing this plate of cookies, knowing he's not supposed to touch it. And then I was part of it, too. So he would sneak over, and then he would look up at me, you know, oh, no. So there was both of us. We both were performing. Not only was the marionette, but I was interacting with him as well. Mm-hmm. And eventually, he steals the cookie, and it's, you know, magnet in the hand, and then runs and hides behind my leg. And mm-hmm. I remember that one a lot.
What was it about puppetry as a way to perform? What did that do for you that just getting up on stage and doing mime or clowning wasn't doing?
It's an inanimate object, and there's just something so fascinating mm-hmm. for that to come alive. And the suspension of disbelief, allowing yourself to believe that that piece of wood or fabric is a real live thing.
Did you put... was there... bit of yourself that you would put into your characters, or
oh yeah, I would say the closest to me would probably Gertha Rotunda. Mm-hmm. She's large and in charge, about 420 pounds. That's for you stoners out there.
Where did you find her?
And I found her at a donut shop in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gertha Rotunda is. Part of, have you heard of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, so explain how that, what that whole world is.
Okay. Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. Walk back to 1979. It's Easter Sunday. And this takes place in San Francisco. And this was at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. A group of fellas had some nun... cornets and habits, and they dressed up in them and went out into public to raise awareness for HIV/AIDS. And they went out, and the public said, "What the fuck?" But at the same time, they said, "We love this. What is this? We want more." So they got their point across, they got the attention that they needed, and then from that point, it kind of snowballed. They were like, "Hey, listen, we have something here." And at that point, they're like, hey, we have something here. So they started doing fundraising, and they were the first to distribute a safer sex pamphlet.
All dressed as nuns with like full makeup and...
Well, go to thesisters.org. Mm-hmm. Go there, do some research. There's tons of videos on the interweb about the sisters. So since that time, 1979, this organization has grown and grown all over the United States and the world, the globe. There are chapters in other parts of the country. Chapters, houses, abbeys, convents, if you will. And not only do they still work very closely with safer sex awareness and raising money for those living with HIV, they work with orphanages and food shelves and clothing banks and any other nonprofit that needs a little help. The sisters will go out and raise money for them. It was, I was in Las Vegas, living in Vegas at the time, and after the show, I decided to go get a drink at the Fun Hog Ranch, which is a little queer bar not too far from my house.
It sounds very, very cute in small town.
Oh, Matt, I think you'd like it. So all of a sudden, the doors fly open, big cloud of smoke, pyrotechnics go off. This is how I remember it. And these three giant acid trip clown nuns walk in. And I say to myself, what the fuck is this? I'm like, I need to know more. So I immediately put down my drink and I walk up to them. And I introduce myself. And they introduce themselves. And I'm like, who are you? And they said, we are the Sin City Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. And I don't think I even finished my drink. I left and I went home and I Googled them. And I read for the next, at least week before I'd go to bed, read more information on this organization and the rich, rich, strong history that they have and what they do to leave the planet just a little bit better. And they do it in this hysterical, gender-bending, self-expression way. And I was like, I would love to be a part of this someday.
What was it about it that you liked? What was that doing?
First of all, that all of a sudden, you know, this dank little bar, all of a sudden, like, this burst of color. You know, I say smoke and pyrotechnics. There were none. But when these nuns came through the door, that's what I saw. It was just this explosion of color, and I mean, my jaw hit the floor, and it just, none of it made sense until I started talking to them. And I the work that they did was just spectacular, and I wanted to be a part of it at some point.
So what'd you do?
Life took control, and I'd gotten a new gig working on a show, and this, I actually started doing costumes for that show. It's called Vegas, the Show at Planet Hollywood. Get your tickets now. Still running. So, work. I was working. And then I was like, listen, it's time for me to leave Las Vegas. And I moved to Minneapolis. And I came here, and was here for about a year. Then I went on tour with Sesame Street.
Who are you performing Sesame Street?
Oh, well, here in Minneapolis, Sesame Street Live is located. Mm-hmm. So right over off of University by Dinkytown, which is awesome because it's track season now. So I highly suggest that you just drive through the Dinkytown campus. Thank God for sports shorts. And
it's just thighs everywhere.
Sure. oscillating loveliness. Anyway, so we build, I mean, literally, mm-hmm. a few miles that way, Big Bird, Elmo, Grover, Cookie Monster mm-hmm. are hanging up over there. So I started working at Sesame Street Live, building the characters.
Okay.
And then was asked to go on a USO world tour with them.
Oh, wow.
So it's the first show for military families. Mm-hmm. And we traveled from military base, because it's like its own little compound on these bases, performing for the kids. I mean, Elmo was a rock star, you know, and it was great. The best part of that was seeing, not the kids, but seeing the parents because they would look at their kids and they were so happy, and it was a little bit of home there with them, that they'd start to cry, and then me peeking through the curtains and bawling backstage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was good. That was most excellent.
Wow, so right. Traveling all over the country.
Yeah,
like
world.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
So maintaining the characters. And,
yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about, like, that experience of just being there on the base. And, like, did you ever... Were you performing at all, or just...
I was head of wardrobe.
Okay.
I was head of wardrobe. So, basically, it's a lot smaller show. It's only six characters, I think. Elmo, Grover, Cookie Monster, Zoe...
Zoe's a little after my time.
She's after. And then there was, I'm missing one. Honker, and then Katie.
Honker's still on Sesame Street? Really?
Oh, of course the Honkers are.
Wonderful.
I have a photo. I should show you the photo of me and the Honker, and it's cute. And then Katie, which is a brand new character that mm-hmm. was designed specifically for the show. And her parents are military.
Oh, wow.
So she's upset because she has to leave Sesame Street. And all of her friends on Sesame Street say it's okay. We can still stay in touch. And that's the gist of the show. So that's a smaller show compared to the big stage versions of Sesame Street Live, where it's semi after semi.
Mm-hmm.
Of set lighting, costumes, the whole shebang shebottle.
At some point you got back here and Gertha became a part of your life.
Yeah. Well, I had come back and off tour, performed at the Guthrie, and then at that time I was like, well, what's next? And I'm like, well, I have time now, and the sisters are here. They just started to make a house here.
Mm-hmm.
Now every house of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence has another name. So, like, in Las Vegas, it's the Sin City Sisters. In Louisville, Kentucky, it is the Derby City Sisters. Shout out, Melvita. And Minneapolis is the Ladies of the Lakes, which, as you know, Minnesota is the land of 10,000 lakes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, they had started that chapter here. It was in the beginning of the stages. And I started going to their little meetings. And yeah. And that's it. The first time I manifested, which is putting on... your white face and going through the ritual of doing that and becoming your sister self, if you will. We had gone out and someone said, oh my gosh, how long did it take you to get ready? And without thinking, I said 5 years. Because from the point when I first met the sisters in Las Vegas to the first time Gertha Rotunda made an appearance, it was 5 years.
What was finally, like, what were you getting ready? What did it take to...
Life. No, honestly, truly, life. Because it's, I didn't have time. I was working. The sisters have become, like, a part-time job, honestly. It is a dedication. You have to be. We're serving our community.
Did something change that you were able to put the work somewhat aside and say, I'm going to focus more on the sisterhood?
Yeah, it was, after the Guthrie, I was like, okay, well, I'm working now. At that time, I was catering tables after, and, which, oh God, it's so unfulfilling. Then joined, the Ladies of the Lakes in Minneapolis,
mm-hmm.
and then started doing flowers. Yeah.
You had that as a sort of a creative outlet.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Totally. Mm-hmm. I mean, my life is totally different after moving to Minneapolis.
So having the sisters and having Gertha and having the floral arranging as a creative outlet, what are you letting out? What are you creating with those, in those roles?
Well, floral designing, you have a piece of temporary artwork. that will then be presented to someone. I mean, you don't really send flowers to someone you hate, do you? Or someone you absolutely loathe?
It's something nice for someone.
Usually. Even if you're dead, people send you flowers. Mm-hmm. Because they make people happy. They bring joy. They bring color and life. And eventually that life fades away. But while they're there, they're just joyous and happy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It sounds like that's something that's been important to you in everything that you do, bringing something happy to people.
I try. Now, am I always happy? Well, no. No one is. My gosh. I mean, I got more issues than Oprah magazine. But I would say for the most part, I am an optimist and a happy person.
What makes you happy?
Oh, gosh. Gummy bears?
Really?
Oh,
the show or the food?
Oh, wow. You're bringing it back now. the food. The
okay.
Food's really good.
Excellent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a good thing to have.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What about, you know, you create so much entertainment. What entertainment do other people create that you like?
I'll tell you. Well, here. When I create, what really helps me is music.
Mm-hmm.
That always gets the ball rolling for me. So that's at the grassroots of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
For me. Uh-huh.
What do you like to listen to?
Show tunes. Guilty. But they tell a story.
Sure.
And I just love it. And through music. And mm-hmm. through song. I really love jazz. I really love jazz music, especially without any words.
Mm-hmm.
When it's all instrumental, that's when my brain works best.
Do you remember the last thing you listened to?
Yes, I do. It's the song called Going Down from Hair the Musical.
Oh.
The newer version
mm-hmm.
of it.
Just like the angel that fell, banished forever to hell. Today, have I been expelled from high school heaven? Elevator going down, going down, going down. Everybody going down.
The new one is actually really fantastic. It comes up on Pandora for me because I try to train Pandora to only play me musical theater.
Oh, I love it. Okay. Yeah. So, Matt, you understand. You have affinity for musical theater.
I understand.
This is good. Yes. This is good. And why do us queer folk? Why? That's another good question. Why are there so many queer people in the arts? I mean, we had a joke at the arts high school. How many straight arts high school kids does it take to screw in a light bulb? Both of them.
Well, that's the great mystery. I think it's because we have a lot that we need to say. Arts and expression is a way of processing something that we don't really have the words for. And so I think a lot of queers use creative projects as a way to get something out that they don't know how to get out otherwise.
But everybody has stuff they want to get off their chest.
Sure, sure. You know, and I think that everybody has a different way of doing it. So for a lot of folks, it might be releasing aggression with sports, or it might be disappearing into the nerdy world of math. And I'm not sure what it is about theater that is just a safe space for queers in the same way that football is a safe space for jocks.
Mm.
But for whatever reason, we feel comfortable there. And you've used it as a way to really affect other people, as a gift for other people.
Mm-hmm.
So you really, you know, whether you're doing Sesame Street or floral design or the ice cream or Pagliacci, you're bringing something really bright and unexpected to people where they might not expect to see something fun.
Mm. Yeah. It's magic.
Well, thanks so much for joining me for the show.
Oh, yeah.
Big thanks to Joe for joining me. For my recommendations this week, I'd like to dive deep into the world of Bertolt Brecht and 20th century German dramaturgy. I believe it was Shakespeare who once... Oh, I'm recording right now. Oh, look who it is. Sister Gertha Rotunda, please, come in. Thank you so much for joining me.
Gosh, hey, man. Thanks so much for having me.
So...
Hey, I'm sorry. Are you peckish? Would you open that cupboard over there? Just
sure.
Grab a bowl out of there. Sorry, the Abbey's just a little bit dusty. Oh, isn't that gorgeous? Oh, thank you. Here. Came all this way, and I have nothing to offer ya.
You've got some donuts? Candy corn. Fantastic.
Oh.
Where I just have yourself some candy corn.
Sure, thank you.
Indulge, if you would.
So, are you from Minnesota?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What part?
Oh, the middle part.
Mm, that's is the best part.
Ain't it always the truth?
So, what line of work are you in?
Oh, God, I'm a nun, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I'll tell you what, part of what we do is to spread universal joy mm-hmm. through community service and expiating stigmatic guilt.
How do you do that?
How do you do that? We're doing it right now. See that smile on your face, kiddo? Perfect.
Oh, God, yeah.
We'll work with the Minnesota AIDS Project.
Oh, they're great over there.
The Aliveness Project. We did Dining Out for Life. Have you heard of Dining Out for Life?
Tell me about it.
Oh, crap. Well, what it is, it's a national event. And one day a year, all of these restaurants, they get together, and they donate a certain percentage to the Aliveness Project, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we went out there, and we hosted at a restaurant, and well, we earned some coin for them. Now, coming up here, we're going to have what we are lovingly referring to as Disco and Biscuits, yeah? Which is going to be a brunch, which mm-hmm. is going to involve singing, dancing, and raising money for a charity of our choice.
So who's the we that you're talking about?
Oh, me and my fellow sisters, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How many of you are there?
Oh, God, what? I think there's 12 of us? Oh, yeah.
Tell me what you do when you're not going out into the community and serving. What do you just do for fun?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I have cats. So I comb a lot of them. And I collect that hair, and I like to knit, you see. So, well, you see that scarf over there? That's all cat hair.
Wow.
Yeah?
That's how many cats do you have?
Well, God, what? There's four? Perhaps five. There's a stray. I'm not sure where he's at, no. There are many ways to skin a cat, Maddie. Oh, you're cute.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's lovely to meet you.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. And you've been listening to The Sewers of Paris.
Thanks again for listening. If you have any thoughts on today's show, please get in touch. Tweet at me, at Matt Baume. And as always, please do let me know what you thought. I'm at Matt Baume on Twitter. Please keep rating and reviewing the show in the iTunes store. Those reviews make a huge difference. Thanks to Drew Streep, who writes, I've been searching for years for a gay pop culture-themed podcast that reached beyond Gaga and Beyoncé. I love having new stories and having new TV, movies, and operas to check out every week. Thanks, Drew. And I would just like us all to take a minute to think about how if you said, I've been searching for a podcast that reached beyond Gaga and Beyoncé just a few years ago, people would assume you were talking about space aliens. Also, check out my YouTube channel for videos about LGBT issues and entertainment. That's youtube.com/Matt Baume. And until next time, croissant.